in the mindfulness tradition of this kind of meditation practice here, we don't want to have that kind of attitude of pushing anything away or rejecting anything or saying this is bad, it shouldn't happen, but rather to begin understanding what is happening. And to help along that lines, it should be said that every human mind has its own strategies for avoiding the present moment. And I say it that way, every human mind has its own strategies, so you won't take it personal. If I said every one of you has a strategy, you might take it, oh, it's something personal with me. It's my hang-up, it's my problem. But I want to say it's every single mind, and the mind is not necessarily you. Different minds, maybe because they were born, genetics, or who knows what, function in different ways and react and respond to stress, to challenges, to difficulties, to beautiful things in different kind of ways. And so it's kind of a natural thing the mind does in a sense. So we don't feel bad about ourselves for it happening. What we do in this tradition is we try to become familiar with those phenomena, try to see and understand it, so that we could get the upper hand. The more familiar you become with how something works, the less power and hold it has over you. So if you can see how aversion works really well, to notice how it begins, notice how it happens, what it's like when you're in the grip of it, to notice the beliefs that are connected to it, to know what it, notice what it feels like in the body, to notice as much as you can about the state of aversion, then it's going to be a lot easier, a lot more difficult for you to get caught by that aversion. You might even see it coming. You could smell it coming. Or you see it, or it does arise, and you're more likely to catch it right away rather than being lost by it or being pulled away by it. The mind has tremendous... there are strong forces in the mind that want to pull you out of the present moment. And what we're trying to do here is to understand what those forces are rather than ignore them or fight them or judge them negatively. So in the Buddhist tradition, there is five primary forces in the mind which are said to be the greatest hindrances to our ability to stay present, to hinder our ability to stay concentrated, stable, alert in the present moment. And it's a little bit curious why they have this list of five, and what about all kinds of other things? It might be that as the meditation gets deeper and deeper and deeper, that these are the ones that are left as being the most subtle ones. A lot of things can drop away, but these are the most tenacious ones that hold on. You know, even when things get very blissful, very very deep in meditation, these can creep in and kind of pull you off to the side, kind of deter a person from the practice. And I think of these, they're called five hindrances, five things that hinder our ability to be present. And it's the job of mindfulness meditators to become connoisseurs of these, to become experts of them, to really get to know them well. To get to know it well, you don't necessarily invite them in, but when they appear, you don't take them as being problems to be destroyed or get rid of as quickly as you can. You take them as something. Oh, I'm going to get to know what this is like. I get to study this a little bit for this phenomena. I think of these five hindrances as being like black holes. You know, these stars that are black holes in the sky and the space. A black hole is a star that's collapsed, and the gravitational force is so strong that what light, when it comes close to the black hole, gets sucked in and doesn't come out. So it's black, you don't see. And there are forces in the mind that take the light of awareness, and the gravitational force is so strong that it pulls our awareness into it, and awareness doesn't come out. And if reality didn't interfere with us, we'd probably get lost in these black holes for long periods of time. We get lost long enough, but then we're walking down the street and then we bump into someone and they say, hey, excuse me. They go, oh, okay, you didn't. Something happens, reality is always happening, so we usually don't go that far away. Sometimes in meditation we go further away than we do in daily life because there isn't all this activity that kind of reminds us of where you are. So there's these black holes, these forces that we lose our awareness. And sometimes it's frightening. A couple of times I remember driving my car and then I couldn't quite remember, how did I get here? Wait a minute. I hope you've never had that experience. And I think I was driving safely, but I just wasn't, you know, I couldn't remember the last 2 minutes, you know. or a more common one, which is maybe not so unsafe, but is missing an exit on the freeway. You know, where was my mind thinking about something wonderful? So there's these forces in the mind that pull awareness, and the awareness is no longer present, but sometimes gets lost in there, and sometimes it gets lost for long periods of time. So what we're trying to do is to kind of overcome that gravitational force by having a stronger force, and there's a number of stronger forces. Mindfulness is one, concentration is another, and familiarity is another. The more familiar you are with something, the less it's going to trick you and fool you into being pulled into its allure. So we need to become experts on this. You can expect, as you meditate, that there are going to be forces that arise that make it difficult for you to be present. Don't be angry or discouraged by that's happening. And in fact, rather take it as, great, this is what happens when people try to be present. They notice how it's difficult to be present, and then now I can try to understand what this is, what's going on. And it's kind of a trick also, because then what you're doing is you bring presence to that phenomena. Isn't that great? So you're kind of reclaiming your presence by focusing on that. Now, if you're successfully able to be present and nothing pulls you out, then just be happy with that. Don't go looking for trouble. Don't go looking for a hindrance. But if they arise, then you want to kind of, oh, there it is. So this is a list of five. The first two and the first pair and the second pair are paired because they're kind of like opposites, and they kind of work similarly but in opposite directions and have sort of similar roots sometimes. So the first two is desire and aversion. Desire and ill will. Desire is sometimes called sensual desire, desire for comfort. Ill will or aversion is pushing things away, not wanting it here. So there's kind of the two movements, right? One is holding on to stuff, wanting something, the other is not wanting it. The second pair is made up of, each part of the pair is made up of two things. So number three, so it's desire and aversion. Number three is sloth and torpor. It's not a word that it's probably in your using vocabulary. You probably don't go around saying torpor a lot or sloth. But these are, you know, popular words in the Buddhist. Sloth is like the animal, the sloth, you know, it's kind of sloth and torpor. And then to match that is number four, or the opposite of that, is anxiety and restlessness. And the reason why there's two in each category, sloth and torpor, sloth is physical and torpor is meant to be mental. And restlessness is meant to be physical and anxiety is meant to be mental. So physical and mental aspect of these same things. And then the fifth one is doubt, indecision, lack of confidence. These can be very powerful. As we know, we have it often, many people in our society dealing with addictions. Addiction is often when they're gripped by the hindrance, what Buddhists would call the hindrance of desire. There are people who are gripped by the hindrance of hate, do tremendously damage to the world. People who are gripped by sloth and torpor. I think of sloth and torpor not being the same thing as tiredness, but it's kind of like more like withdrawal or a depression or a resistance to what's going on. I call it my Sears mind, because my mom was, when I was like 11 or 12, my mom would take me to Sears to buy clothes for me, and I hated it. And as soon as we walk into Sears, I was, oh, I'm so tired. So tired. And as soon as we left, you know, especially if you said to me, well, should we go out buy some ice cream or something? But as soon as we left, I could feel myself kind of, you know, wake up. And my tiredness had to do with Sears, nothing to do with me, right? Sears was responsible for my tiredness. But, you know, it was my resistance, my despair, my all the associations I had with what we were doing. And restlessness and anxiety is often fear-based and has to do with a lot of, partly with confusion, a lot of energy, a lot of indecision. And then doubt, it said, is the most dangerous of the five hindrances. Because doubt is the one that can get you to stop doing what you're doing. For example, if you're doing a spiritual practice, it can get you to stop doing the practice. So it's kind of interesting that doubt is the most dangerous one. Sometimes these five hindrances are understood as strategies. Sometimes they're strategies of how people deal with situations that are challenging. We find ourselves in a challenging situation, and some people, some minds, reaction to that is desire. It can take a different forms. Like you're in an uncomfortable situation, and so you start fantasizing about some wonderful situation in the future. You start fantasizing about, you know, anything, a vacation or a great sexual partner or great food or whatever. So you don't have to be present for the discomfort. Some people's strategy is to attack, have aversion, find every possible thing that's wrong with that person. The socks they're wearing, you know. How could they wear those kinds of socks? You know, that proves, that's absolute proof that the person's a, you know, imbecile. So just to have the minds, you know, fixated on externals. Some years ago, I remember I had this little funny moment where I had a cold, I was sick, and I was getting kind of bored. And then UPS knocked on my door, and they delivered a package I wasn't expecting, a big box, and it was a children's play structure, plastic one, kind of little building kind of build. And so I signed for it, and he left me there, and it was also drizzling outside a little bit. It was an outdoor play structure. And because of my boredom and being uncomfortable, I kind of, my desire latched onto that. Great, something to do. And the box said, you know, it can be put together in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And I believed it, right? So I got out there in the rain, and I started hammering and negotiating, trying to get this going. And it took longer, and after by the time I finally got it done, then I paid attention to how I was feeling, and I was drained and exhausted. I was sick, right? And I was out there in the rain doing all this physical work. And so I did the logical thing. I blamed UPS. You know, how could he have brought it? I mean, that's what my mind did, a spontaneous thing. You know, it's amazing what the mind does. The mind has no shame. You know, the mind just does all these things. And luckily I saw at that moment, oh, and I kind of smiled. What a ridiculous thing to do. But sometimes if a person's not trained to pay attention, it can get it out of hand. You know, suddenly you're blaming UPS and you're writing a letter, and, you know, it's nothing to do with UPS. It had to do with me. And it chose, and I was kind of responding to my discomfort being bored, by first by my desire to do something. And then I was responding to my discomfort of realizing I'd really done myself a disservice. I was drained by attacking something outside of me, so I wouldn't have to take responsibility. So they're kind of a movement sometimes of avoiding challenges or things that are really difficult. And each of you probably has your own favorite strategy. Desire in meditation can often take the form of fantasy. We get pulled into fantasy. Sometimes planning fantasies are a desire, we want something. Sometimes planning fantasies have to do with aversion. Sometimes they have to do with anxiety. But they pull us out of the present moment. Sometimes desire in meditation can be about planning or hoping or wanting a better meditation experience. You know, just kind of thinking constantly, you know, oh, I want something better here. I want something better here. Sometimes it can take the form of having something good happening in meditation, some nice feeling, and then holding on to it, grabbing it, and saying, I can't let this go. Aversion can take the form of fantasy also. Mind gets carried on fantasies, you know, how are you going to do these terrible things to whatever, or what they deserve, or whatever. Or it can be, it can take the form of a self-criticism or self-blame. It can take the form of a certain kind of analysis, which is very critical in nature. It can be a kind of attack on what our present moment experience is. We have knee pain in meditation. And so rather than just being present for it, we're kind of attacking it, or kind of there's aversion to it, get away. And I remember at times when I've had knee pain, noticing that my aversion to the knee pain cause me to contract around the pain and cause more pain. And so the very, you know, my very reaction to it, my aversion to it, was actually making it worse. And when I could learn not to react to it, then, you know, it was still painful, but it wasn't bad. It was quite manageable. So, and watching that operate. So one of the things we're trying to do then in meditation is to learn to track and notice how these strategies operate, what it is that pulls us away. And what you might try doing is use these categories as a way of helping you make it simpler. And so you don't get caught up in the story of what's going on. So if you're planning a lot, rather than kind of maybe noting and paying attention to it as planning, you might notice it as anxiety or restlessness. Or if you know, having all kinds of fantastic sexual desire, rather than getting complicated in the story of what that's all about, you can just notice it, oh, there's desire operating. Desire is pulling me out of the present moment. Or doubt, or whatever it might be. So each of these things is to be investigated and to be understood and become familiar with. As you become more familiar with them, then also sometimes you can use an antidote to them. If you feel like you're really stuck in them and you really want to try to pull yourself out of it, sometimes there's antidotes to be used. Very simply, the antidote for desire, there's a lot of antidotes that are given, but one of the common antidotes for desire is to look at the problem of being the disadvantages of being caught up in desire. One of the antidotes to ill will is to look, with all of them, is to look at the disadvantage you have of being caught by these. And sometimes to really see the disadvantage helps the mind free its interest in being caught by these things. To, you know, sometimes we have a constant fantasy. Maybe it's a beautiful, I mean, part of the reason why desire fantasies are so alluring is they're seductive, they're very pleasant, and we get pulled into their pleasantness. But if you have the same fantasy 20,000 times, after a while, it doesn't seem so interesting anymore, and you realize you're missing out on a lot of presence, of a lot of vitality and a lot of life. So you start seeing the disadvantage, and then the mind begins to relax its interest in desire or aversion. Anyway, I find myself a little bit going kind of fast in my own mind, maybe too fast in my speaking, because there's so much to be said about the five hindrances. It's just, I could go on for probably days to talk about them. And on Sunday, actually on Sundays, for the next maybe five Sundays or so when I'm around, I'm going to go through the five hindrances one at a time. So if you want to, you know, get them in a little bit more detail than I can here, you might want to come there. So the main lessons I'm trying to get across today is that there will be obstacles that arise that make it difficult for you to be present. Don't take them personally. Don't take them as being something to be fought against or be angry about. But rather, take them as something to investigate and get to know, to become familiar with. As you become familiar with it, then it probably be less seductive for you, or have less of a hold on your mind. And then it'll be easier for you to stay present. You might see the hindrance arise, say, I don't have to go with that. Thank you. See, doubt arises, it's easier to let go of it. I don't have to be caught up in doubt. I've heard that Buddhist meditators have had doubt for 2,500 years. It's really common. Probably every meditator who's ever meditated has had doubt at some point. Now it's my turn. Let's not take this seriously. Let's not get caught by this. Or whatever these hindrances might be. Yes, please.
Why isn't the body listed as one of the hindrances?
The hindrances are what takes us out of the present moment. The body helps us stay present. So how does the body work as a hindrance?
I may have a muscle that's, you know, twitching, or a joint that's not cooperating, you know, not in a posture that, you know, the body is sending signals to the brain saying, hey, pay attention to me.
Yeah, so pay attention to it. That's all you have to do. So in our meditation, we don't stick to one object as the object of meditation. Like, we don't stick to the breath. But rather, whatever is happening in the present moment, we bring our attention to it. So if there's strong sensations, we stay with the breath first. And then if there's strong sensations in the body that's making it difficult for us to be with the breath, then we let go of the breath and bring our meditative awareness to those sensations in the body. And those sensations become the meditation.
So by that same logic, desire is just like the body. If it's happening and trying to pull me out of the present, I just pay attention to it.
That's what I'm teaching you today. That's what I'm telling you to do.
So my point is that it looks like desire is on the same footing as the body. They're both trying to pull you and you just go pay attention to them.
With a little bit there's a little bit different. Because with the body, body sensations get stronger and stronger. People tend to get more and more present. I mean, you're not going to be thinking about your bank account when your knees are burning. I mean, you're just there. And sometimes very strong, intense body sensations make it really easy to be present. Desire fantasies, when they're quite intense, often become black holes. We get pulled into them, and the awareness gets lost in them. So whereas the body tends to accentuate presence, it might make it difficult for you to be concentrated on the breath. I grant that. But if you let go of the breath and focus on the body sensation, it's quite compelling. And you'll really wake up. I've known people who, myself also, have been quite sleepy and groggy and kind of things are kind of cloudy. And then some kind of pain arose in meditation. And within a few seconds or moments, you know, I am really alert. You know, I've woken up and I'm really there. Fantasy has a tendency of pulling us into another world, its own world of thoughts. And so it tends to be a trap. What we're trying to do is not necessarily get rid of desire, but we're trying to reclaim our presence, our awareness. And it's possible to do that with any of the hindrances. The hindrance doesn't have to go away, but we have to see very clearly this is what's happening in the present moment. So that involves kind of separating ourselves a little bit from the desire so we're not in its trap or in its allure. Is that making some sense?
Yeah. But for example, this lady over here was having pain. She said pain caused her created aversion.
Yes.
So a body sensation created one of your five hindrances. In fact, the body could have been the originator.
Yes. Wow. Yes. The pain does not create aversion. Ever.
Pain
is a condition for the mind or, to react and create aversion. And what we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is to learn to deal with that reaction and be wise and be attentive and have mindfulness powerful enough so that we become free of the reactivity of the mind. And so many times for untrained minds, the reaction and experience are completely entangled. But we can actually tease them apart, and as we tease them apart, it's possible to let go of the reaction. And that's partly where freedom is found. But if you can't tease them apart, if you don't have the presence to see that. So with desire, both desire and aversion often have objects that they're concerned about. And one way to be present for desire and aversion that pulls us out of their trap is to turn the attention away from the object and notice what it feels like to be desiring, what it feels like for you to be having aversion. So if you have tremendous desire for, food, stop thinking about the food, stop focusing on the food, but turn around and feel like what it's like in your body to be churning away or fantasizing or twisted up around wanting that food. So what's the subjective state like while you're desiring? What's the subjective state like when you're having aversion? And as you do that, you're reclaiming your presence. And that's kind of what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, is to reclaim that presence. And you can reclaim your presence with any of the hindrances. But the thing is, we often slip back. And so you have to keep doing it and keep becoming more familiar with it and keep developing the power and the strength of your mind to keep yourself out of that sand trap of these five hindrances. Does that make some sense? Yes.
Talking about doubt, it seems like doubt could be quite well-founded and useful. And how do you... I sort of times when doubt's crept up where it's just doubting, but there's been other times when it was correct and changed whatever I was doing because of the doubt.
Sure.
How do you, I mean, this is sounding like doubt is just, you know, a problem, something to be, keep hate by. What right. do you do with it? How do you decide if it's legitimate?
Well, remember, a hindrance is a black hole in the mind. So any kind of doubt can be a black hole if we get lost in the doubt. But if you can pull yourself up enough out of it and be present for the doubt, then you maybe can use your wisdom to know, is this a useful doubt or not to have? And hopefully you can make that decision for yourself. But it's really common, you know. I mean, so remember, sometimes strategies to discomfort or to being challenged is sometimes doubt. This wasn't the right day to meditate, the right time to meditate. This is not the right meditation practice. It's not the right meditation teacher. It's not the right religion. It's not the right world to be born into. You know, these doubts about what we're doing. And we're so churned up by the doubt that we're no longer present. And so we need to see that. Oh, that's what's happening. I'm no longer present. Okay? So let's do another little meditation. So if you like to stand, you've been sitting for a while, stand and stretch for a few moments. Taking an alert and relaxed posture. Gently closing your eyes. And then letting yourself be at ease. And your body be at ease, your mind, your heart. Even if you feel uneasy in some way, see if you can set yourself at ease about that uneasiness. Being present, being attentive, being aware of what's happening in the present moment is one of the most precious resources we have as a human being. One of the tasks of meditators is to notice what obstructs this resource, this ability we all have, what gets in the way of it. As we're sitting here for the next 5 minutes, focus on your breathing. Be attentive to each breath as carefully as you can. But then when you lose your awareness, when you find yourself being pulled into your thoughts, see if it's possible to notice if one of the five hindrances is operating. Notice what it feels like to be present. Be present for the breath. And then notice how it feels very different. How it feels different to lose that presence, to lose your connection to the present moment. Appreciate that difference. You don't have to get rid of a hindrance. You have to establish an awareness, a presence, that's stronger than the gravitational force of the hindrance. Letting your awareness be larger, more spacious, more open, more stable. Letting yourself clearly see. This is a distraction. This is desire. This is aversion. This is sloth and torpor. This is restlessness and anxiety. And this is doubt. So something you might try doing in your daily life is to see how these five hindrances operate outside of meditation. Do they operate in other circumstances of your life? And chances are they do. And do you have one of them which is your favorite? I think some people have, you know, all five in equal dosages. But most people, usually will specialize in one more than the other. And at different times, I have different ones that have become strong for different reasons. But I would say that the most common one I have is desire. That's in terms of hindrance, my most common theme. And other people have aversion. Some people have sloth and torpor as the most common ones. Some people doubt. Some people restlessness or anxiety. But why don't you see if you can notice it, your favorite, which is the most common that you have. And the value of noticing that is that then maybe you can kind of work with it, kind of come to terms with it or explore it. Some people don't notice patterns in their lives. They don't notice that they're always planning or they're always anxious. I'm anxious now, but if you start kind of tracking how things continue through time, you say, well, this is odd. It seems like I'm always thinking about the future, or I'm always, you know, fantasizing about some wonderful, you know, dessert, or I don't know, something. And then if you can see the patterns, then you can come to terms with it, perhaps, and work with it and explore it. It's a very rich world, the world of the hindrances. It's a very important world to study and get to know. The hindrances debilitate people dramatically, and they cause major problems for others and for ourselves when they're strong. And even when they're not strong enough that we act on them, in meditation they can be, you know, really derail in meditation practice if we get lost in these for a long time. So get to know them, and hopefully as you continue your meditation practice, you'll through your own study of them, your own investigation of them, from teachings you get and from books that you read, you'll learn a whole new a variety of approaches of how to work with them. It's a never-ending study until you become fully enlightened. So until that day, be content that these things will arise, and that the part of the practice at times is to work with them. So that's what I have in mind. If some of you have further questions you'd like to ask about it, I'll stay hip behind for a little while. I welcome questions. And then next week we'll take a very different slant on meditation by talking about the five faculties. And whereas today was talking about the kind of the hindrances, the kind of things that make problems for meditation, the five faculties are things that actually support and help meditation more directly.
Is there a hand up?
No. I'm sorry that I created this expectation that through the intro. Sorry?
Do you have an aversion to hand-ups?
No, I wrote in intro class. I had four of them, one for each for the first 4 weeks, but I've never gotten around to writing one. But what you can do, if you get my book that's there on the table, if you have a copy, I believe there's a chapter in there on the hindrances, isn't there? I've forgotten what's in my own book because I don't read it. So you might, that could be the handout. So, yes?
Are these talks destined for the web?
This one?
Yeah.
I'm going to miss the next 2 weeks, which is perhaps maybe,
yeah. Probably, if Allison's kind enough to come, it's...
I know the first and third are, I'm not sure about the second.
Okay.
Can it be two?
We'll try to tape it one way or the other. If Allison can't come, then I can. It's hard for me to operate that from there. But I have this little digital tape recorder I can hang around my neck, and it makes a pretty good quality recording. So maybe I can do that way. Then we can download it from there. Yeah.
What category would you classify daydreams? If you imagine a daydream, you'd be a little moody, mind is going up. It's not the same kind of daydream. It's different genres.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if we need to put everything into the categories of the five hindrances. I think that's a problem to try to force everything into that. There's other things that make it difficult for us to be present besides the five hindrances. The five hindrances are kind of understood as the most tenacious ones. But often daydreams belong to some of the categories. I mean, it's very common to have daydreams which are desire daydreams. And there can also be aversion daydreams, you know, what you're going to do to that sucker. And then there can be other ones that can arise. So you have to kind of look at the quality of each daydream to see what, you know, what it might be. Yeah?
Is there one place that you would put fear? Like, is it most likely to be aversion or...
That's interesting. I think myself, I wouldn't put it necessarily in one particular one. It depends on the kind of fear it is. Restlessness and anxiety is a kind of fear. It's kind of fear-based, so that's a good place for it. But fear is also understood to be a form of aversion. So sometimes it seems to fit better into the aversion category. I don't know if you need to kind of decide which is the right category, but rather to use these categories as a way to help you to work with it. Okay. Thank you.